The following is an Auburn Network production.
You are on the line. Live on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader. Online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app. To be on the line, call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502. You are on the line with Jacob Goins.
You're on the line here on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika sports leader. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well on this August 13th, 2024. This is On the Line, the show that tells you like it is and holds nothing back. I'm your man, Jacob Goins, with you for the next 2 hours right here on ESPN 106.7. And man, do we have just a ton to talk about on the show today. Yesterday was a lot of fun with Uncle T-Bone back in the studio. He will be back on Friday. And as promised throughout football season, basketball season, and as long as we can have him. Christian Griffin, voice of the Lee Scott Warriors, is with us on this Tuesday afternoon. My man, great to see you once again. We are putting in the work for high school football that begins next Friday night, my man.
Yeah, you brought it up to me the other day. You were like, hey, it's next Friday when you're going to be over at Just God calling a football game. I was like, no, it's still three Fridays. And you were like, No. It is, it is two Fridays, and now you're looking at it next Friday when both of us will be on the air, not in the same booth anymore, which we're both still trying to get a little used to, but we're both really excited as Auburn High and Lee Scott take the field for the first time next Friday night.
Yeah, and we'll continue to kind of hype that up and get ready for that next Friday. Auburn High will be on Wings 94.3, Lee Scott over on AU 100, and so we have that over the next 2 weeks. We've got so much college football to talk about that you and I will get to in hour number two, talking a little bit more about that preseason top 25. I know there's been some talk about what Auburn could do and maybe when they can make an appearance in that top 25 and things like that. So we'll get into that coming up in hour number two. But excited that it is Tuesday, and we did not have it last week, but back on the airwaves is Lindsey Crosby for our baseball power hour, because it's getting down to some really important weeks in the baseball season. So, Lindsey, it is great to see you as well. Unfortunately, didn't make it happen last week, which means we just got to make up for it this week.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be with these amazing microphones again.
Yeah.
I just love how I sound in these. But yes, we are back. We are in the stretch. There is, you know, roughly 5 or 6 weeks left in the MLB season. And so it's getting crunch time. I mean, we've played, I think it's, Braves have played 118 games. So they've got, you know, what, I can't do math in my head, 44 left maybe? And they're done.
Don't look at me. I'm a journalism major.
There you go. Listen, I do a bunch of banking stuff normally, so we have calculators for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2024. Is anybody really doing math in their head nowadays? I mean, that's what your phone is for. No, I'm just kidding. It's unbelievable to think that we are 5 weeks remaining in the baseball season. I mean, I literally remember you being in the studio on opening week, Lindsey, like opening week of the baseball season. And here we are, August is here, football's here, and baseball's coming down to the wire. It's crazy.
And the cool thing is almost every single division race is still up for grabs. Like there is not a single division where just one team has completely run away with it. Despite how it feels, right? It feels like, oh yeah, the Dodgers are probably like, you know, running away. No, they're 3.5 games up on both Arizona and San Diego. The biggest lead is actually, believe it or not, in the National League Central. The Milwaukee Brewers have a 7.5 game lead on the Cardinals and 9 games on the Cubs, but everybody else is closer and in contention. The next biggest lead is the Braves are 7 games back of the Phillies, but guess what? They've got 7 games remaining with the Phillies, and every one of those games counts double in the standings. So even that one is closer than it looks.
Well, I think that's a really good spot to start today. And if you're new here or haven't been with us on a lot of Tuesdays in this first hour, we do our baseball power hour. Bring Lindsey in, who has about 50 different acclamations now in terms of what he does for baseball coverage. And it's just so much fun to come in. It's the one pure hour a week that we just talk baseball. Nothing else. It's pure baseball for an hour, talking the MLB, talking the Atlanta Braves. I know you said you have a couple Auburn updates at the end of this hour that we'll get to in terms of Auburn baseball. And so it's a lot of fun. And we want you to be a part of this if you're out there listening. 334-321-1390. If you have any questions about what's going on in baseball, standings or the Braves, anything like that, we'll do our best to help you out on that. Or you can just shoot us a text in the On the Line text box, 334-784-1067. And I think it's a great spot to start with a lot of those standings updates, right? What's happening around Major League Baseball, including the Atlanta Braves, who are just in survival mode still, trying to hang around until they can put something together. And last night was a pretty good start.
Last night was legitimately, I've watched a lot of baseball this year, as you can imagine. Like this calendar year, just a ton of baseball. That was the best game that I have seen, college, pro, all year. Minors, majors, was Chris Sale, who is the Cy Young frontrunner in the National League for the Atlanta Braves.
That's my man.
Versus Blake Snell, last year's Cy Young winner in the National League. They faced off last night in a game that was literally historic. The two guys combined for 23 strikeouts, no runs allowed. And it is the most strikeouts from a pair of starters in Oracle Park history. That ballpark was open for the 2000 season. So in 24 years, no game has had more strikeouts from a starter or from two starters than that game last night. Braves ended up winning in 10 innings, 1-0. Just amazing pitching matchup. 33 total strikeouts in the game. Just dominance up and down from both starters and relievers.
And how frustrating is it if you're Taylor Rogers, you give up the ghost runner winning run, and you're now recorded with the loss in a game that is finalized 1-0 thanks to a Travis d'Arnaud sacrifice fly?
I have long kind of said that they need to find some way other than the loss to denote that situation. Because if it's not an earned run, it feels like it shouldn't count against you.
Right.
Right? I mean, like, if you look at what Taylor Rogers did in that inning, he gave up one hit, and they lost the game, and it wasn't even a home run. It was an out. He gave up a hit, and then there also was a fly ball out. I'm sorry. But it feels weird to give him the loss in the 10th inning for doing his job.
Allowing one base runner and then getting three straight outs. One of them just happened to be a fly ball that was hit just deep enough to score the run at third base.
The expectation is, okay, if you're not perfect, sorry. Yeah. Like, that doesn't seem fair.
But that's kind of the issue, right, is every other pitcher in the game. I mean, there was eight pitchers in that game, and every other pitcher went through their outing without a run allowed. And he was the only one that allowed one. Granted, it was the ghost run of the Manfred man, whatever you want to call him.
Are you a fan of that? After we've seen it for a little bit in the game, are you a fan of the extra inning ghost runner to speed up the game?
I don't mind the concept. I think they could tweak the implementation, right? The stated reason for that rule was they didn't want these games to drag on like you've seen 16, 17, 18 innings and things like that. Okay, fine. Let us play one normal inning in extras before you start. Like, football has the thing where they change it to the two-point conversion after, I think, the second.
So they made it now after the first.
After the first now?
Yeah, so they continue to change that.
Something like that. Play the 10th inning like normal. And if the game doesn't end then maybe go ahead and do something like this.
Yeah.
Because it's just, the game should look like the same game, right? And if you're going to make this change, the stated reason was to not have those games go 12, 13 innings. Well, sometimes you have the ghost runner and it still goes for one or two innings.
My comparison to that, because I agree with that, my comparison is college football, right? How you have your extra overtimes that you do start on the 25 or whatever, and you've had all those different changes, but then it was, okay, now that it's the third overtime or the fourth overtime, now we're going to go for two or do whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They waited until you had a few extra normal periods before taking a drastic change to get the game over with, which is what baseball, I agree. I think baseball should do something like that. Now, I know college football has changed that about a million times, but you see what I'm saying.
And even the NFL has something where in overtime, it's not immediately sudden death unless it's a touchdown scored, right?
Which, like, I still think is
dumb. If you drive down the field and kick a field goal, the other team has a chance to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, even there, they try to give a little bit of normalcy to the game. There's no other time in football except for the very end of the game where a field goal ends the game. Like, you know, it's and so they say, okay, if you get a field goal in overtime, that's great. We're going to give them a chance to get one too before we wrap up. I just think it's give us one more inning. Give us one more normal inning, and then let's go to the funky extra rules.
Yeah, because so many different things and so many weird things happen in that 10th inning. You see guys finally decide to start playing the small ball before they did implement the ghost runner. Yeah. And it even comes to it, again, now that the playoffs don't have it, they want it to continue to be real baseball, and it matters with so many different things. Even with college football now, as we're talking about the two-point conversion, you now have to go for the two-point conversion after you score the touchdown in the second overtime. Mm-hmm. So it's no longer the third. Last year it was the start of the third overtime. You went for two and you traded. Now you have to go for it at the end of the second overtime. It seems like they're continuing to change so many things. We think about it just a couple years ago, the seven overtime game with LSU and Texas A&M, where it was 74-72, and none of America complained that the game went almost 5 hours.
And another example on the baseball side is a few years ago when my Red Sox were in the World Series against the Dodgers. They played 18-plus innings in that game. They played a whole separate game in the World Series. It was phenomenal. Now, it was like 2 in the morning when the game went off, but who cares? It was the World Series. That's a little extreme, but another example of that.
Yeah, and like the funniest thing about that to me is they both scored in the 13th inning, and then they played five more. Like Nathan Eovaldi, in essence, made another start. He pitched six innings with no notice. They were
crazy.
Like, "Oh, hey man, we're gonna put you in for the 13th because we have burned through the bullpen."
Yeah,
and he just took the ball for six innings. Did not have his pregame prep. I mean, he did not go to bed the night before with his big bowl of pasta and all that. It was great to me. I thought that was fantastic. But just like imagine trying like that now, you would never get there. And I'm not saying a lot of games did that, but it feels like it was fixing a problem that didn't really need to get fixed.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and just split the difference. Just say, okay, that's fine. Let's do it after a normal 10th inning. But I don't make the rules here.
So with the game last night, which is how all this got started with the Braves, talk about the impact of what this win means. You already mentioned that the Braves are still behind the Phillies, but have a lot of games left with the Phillies. It's been very up and down. Braves have still been dealing with injuries here and there. What did the win last night mean in a game that you said was the best you've seen all year?
I think the big thing here is this team has been able to kind of use that to move on from that collapse on Sunday. If you missed that or were not watching on Sunday, they go into the eighth inning in Colorado. They're tied in the series 1-1. They give up seven runs in the eighth inning, and they do it in the span of like 12 pitches. It's incredibly fast. Lose the game, drop the series, go to San Francisco. All of the media reports about the clubhouse, everybody was down. The mood was bad.
Well, sure.
And they've washed that. The good thing here is you get a good rebound, but you have stumbled recently. Atlanta's 3-7 in their last 10 games, but Philly's only 4-6. And so you haven't seized the opportunity to gain ground on Philly, but you haven't lost ground. You were 7 games back 2 weeks ago. You're still 7 games back. So you have a chance because you played them for 7 games. And then you've got a lot of guys coming back from injury, which to me is sorely needed because they have struggled severely. The staff in the second half has had, going into yesterday, Atlanta had gone from the best ERA in baseball before the All-Star break to the 28th overall ERA after the break, going into yesterday's game. So that's before... That is before Chris Sale did Chris Sale things yesterday. A 10-inning shutout will help your ERA a bit. But we saw the offense score plenty of runs in Colorado. Granted, that's Colorado. We saw the pitching kind of come around with there. You get Michael Harris II back, which everybody's talking about what he's going to do to the lineup, but I'm more interested in what he's going to do for the defense.
Yes.
Because in all of my time of watching Braves baseball, of watching baseball this year, the Atlanta outfield defense with the combination of Jorge Soler and Wright, who played, I think, 25 games in left field for the Miami Marlins last year and DH'd every game this year before he got traded. And then some combination of Adam Duvall and Jared Kelnick and Ramon Laureano. That may have been the worst defensive outfield in baseball. We saw the same play go wrong multiple times. We saw both Saturday and then again last night, a shallow fly ball in right center field just drop between three or four different players. We've seen it multiple times now. Laureano didn't get there on Saturday. He did get nicked up in that game with the heel issue, but he didn't get there. Soler called off the second baseman. Dovin missed it. Last night, it was charging error to Laureano. He actually ran in too far and overran the ball, and it landed behind him.
Classic.
Yeah, and so we've already seen them DFA Eddie Rosario. I think Laureano's probably on his way out when Michael Harris comes back, and it's going to significantly improve the outfield defense when you can put Kelnick back in left. You can have Harris in center, who I think is a top five defensive center fielder, and then he can help cover for Jorge Soler in right. And then Renato Lopez should be back by the end of the week, the beginning of next week.
It's nice to hear that it's going the other way. They're finally getting guys back rather than, oh, look, another addition to the IL. You know what I mean?
And Renato Lopez left a start 2 weeks ago, and they waited almost a week to put him on the injured list because they wanted to see, could he throw a bullpen? Could he come back or not? They decided to IL him, but it meant that he got a good little break. We've talked on here before about moving from relief to starting. He's already way over his innings. He pitched 66 innings last year as a reliever. He's already at 104 and two-thirds.
Wow.
The ERA is still really good, 206. But in his last couple starts, it looked like you were starting to see some of the signs of fatigue. He was getting a little bit looser on his control, so his walks were ticking up a little bit, things like that. Obviously, he's still keeping runs off the board, but a little bit of worrisome signs there. So he has a rehab start tonight in Gwinnett for the Stripers. After that, he'll be on track to either start the final game of the road trip in LA on Sunday versus the Angels, or at home next Tuesday against the Phillies.
We will continue our baseball power hour talking Braves, talking Major League Baseball, Auburn updates as well, and we have a text about the Red Sox. We'll talk about all that and more when we come back here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7. Call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502.
Back inside the studio here at ESPN 106.7, full house here in hour number one. I'm Jacob Goins, joined with the voice of Lee Scott, Christian Griffin, and for our baseball power hour, it is Lindsey Crosby. Tell the people where they can find you, what all you got going on, my man.
I'm on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. It's kind of the hub for everything, but you've got the baseball writing. I'm a beat writer for the Atlanta Braves, bravestoday.com. You've got Auburn Baseball, auburndaily.com, and we have a new daily Major League Baseball show called First Pitch, wherever you get your podcasts, and on YouTube to search for First Pitch Podcast.
And if you want to learn more about what's happening inside the Braves, every single game, every run that's scored, every sort of update, that's the Twitter account that you follow. Gives runs, gives updates, dives a little bit deeper into just a necessary ESPN statistic saying that Travis d'Arnaud hits a home run. It goes into a lot more detail. Definitely worth a nice little Twitter follow.
No doubt about it. Well, we'll get that. Wow, look at that. Yeah. Wow. We'll get back to the Braves in just a second.
I got to follow back the other day, too.
Moving up in the world. Yeah. I mean, that's what happens when you become the voice of Lee Scott. You do start to get perks like that.
13th follower.
I don't think you realize. They said an alert out to the media when that happened, and they were like, hey, just you need to know this.
It's
like,
true.
Okay, yep, follow, let's go.
Hey, making waves in the community.
Shout out MLB.
Man. Shout out MLB. Well, we'll get back to the Braves in a second. I was not lying, I promise. I didn't make this up. We do have a question about the Red Sox. My boy Jeff down in Enterprise, who listens every day, we appreciate him. Hey, he is a Red Sox fan like myself, and he's asking us here in studio, will the Red Sox have a postseason this year, possibly a wild card chance?
Ooh, okay.
Which is a really tough question because I want to say yes, but I just don't feel great about it, Lindsey. I don't.
I've got two reasons why I think it's possible. I'm not saying yes. I'm saying it's possible. The first reason is that the Central is incredibly in flux right now. Cleveland Guardians leading the Central. They're 3-7 in their last 10 games. They've won three straight, so they lost seven straight games. They have been on the struggle bus, pitching-wise, offensively. One of the two teams ahead of Boston in the wildcard standings is the Minnesota Twins, who just lost Joe Ryan for probably the entire season, And same thing, they lost Byron Buxton. It was the day that ends in Y, so he got hurt and had to leave the game. I love Byron Buxton. I'd love if he was healthy. He's a great player. He just hasn't been healthy in his entire career.
Right.
So Boston, two games out of the wild card. I think they have a chance, depending on if the pitching can maintain and how they do in some of these head-to-head matchups. Because their schedule coming up, it is the 12th hardest in baseball down the stretch. As of this morning, they have 14 games against teams that are currently leading their division. They've got three against the Astros. They've got four against the Yankees and seven against the Orioles. The Yankees aren't technically leading, but they were tied as of yesterday, so I'm considering them a leader there.
Yeah, I mean, they're a half game back today.
Exactly. They've also got three against the Twins. They've got three against the Diamondbacks, who have gotten a lot of pitching back. They've lost a lot of hitting, but they're currently a playoff team as of now. And then three against the Mets. And they don't have a lot of super easy series. They got three against the White Sox, two against the Rangers, three against the Tigers. If they can beat up on Toronto, they've got eight against Toronto. So they can handle their business against Toronto, and they can hold serve in these matchups against Baltimore and New York. I think they can get that final wild card spot, which is not a place I thought we would be when the season started. And honestly, the Yankees are on a bit of a struggle bus right now. Luis Gill got blown up yesterday when the team got blown up by the White Sox.
By the worst team in baseball.
When you let the Chicago White Sox set their season high in runs against you, that's not a good thing. And then you also lost Jazz Chisholm to an elbow injury. He had an MR. He had X-rays after the game. They came back negative, which I always found that wording weird.
I've always thought that.
They did see bones in there. It's not negative. They didn't see a fracture, but like there was a response on the X-ray. You have
it was
bones
negative
in there.
For
it was negative for a break or something.
Correct. I've always thought that. Yeah, I've always said that in baseball. It's like, same. Oh, it came back negative. Oh, it's bad. No, came back negative. It's good. Wait. That, like, the wording doesn't work there.
Yeah, it doesn't. He has an MRI today. We don't have the results as of now. It'll probably come out as soon as I'm done with this hour because that's how things always work.
Of course.
But I still think that New York's going to be able to hang on for a playoff spot.
Boom.
I think knocking off the Twins is probably the path. So root for the Royals. You want the Royals to do well to kind of beat up on the Twins some. They've got five against the Twins and seven against the Guardians. So if you can be a Kansas City fan, they can probably knock both those teams close to knock them down a peg, so you can overtake them and get a playoff spot.
I'll say this as a former or as a fellow. That's what I was looking
there
for. Fellow Red Sox fan, because my guy Jeff always taking care of us and getting us an 8-minute segment on the Red Sox. I love it. As a Red Sox fan, I am fine with where we are, because if we get to the playoffs, that means we beat a lot of good teams and we proved that we're a playoff team. If we can't handle the schedule that's in front of us, then we probably don't need to be in the playoffs anyway, which is not always the case with teams at this time of the year. You'll see teams that have an extremely easy schedule, like a crazy hard schedule. Red Sox are kind of there in the middle where, yeah, we're playing the Yankees and the Orioles and teams like that. And to me, it'll prove, like, all right, you win and beat some of these good teams, then, yeah, you deserve to be in there, and good luck. If you can't, then we'll play for next year.
And I do think that getting through some of the postseason, it's going to come down to what's the status of Nick Pivetta. He looked really good early in the year. I mean, he was locked down. Last couple starts have been a little iffy. Colorado, granted it was in Colorado, but they tagged him for 8 runs and 2 2/3. He didn't make it 5 innings against Texas. I think it was last week. So if Nick Pivetta can be, I'm going to say, can be one of your postseason starters, and he's back to early season Nick Pivetta, I think you've got to rotate. You've got three guys that can get hot. Tanner Houck can get hot. Cutter Crawford, Brayan Bello can shut down a lineup when that changeup's working. Like, you've got the rotation that can do it. You've got enough guys in the pen. Kenley Jansen. I like Cam Boozer. Not everybody does. I like Cam Boozer. I think he's good enough at what he does. I like the swing and miss Zach Kelly has. I think you've got enough guys in the rotation, and obviously you've still got some bats. Oh, one more reason, too. Bailey Horn. You've got an Auburn guy in your bullpen. You should feel good about that.
Yeah, there you go, Jeff.
Red Sox, again, we're projected to finish 17th in the league. That was where they started the preseason power ranking. So you already were looking on the outside in. So if you're telling a bunch of Red Sox fan where you're sitting right now, I think a bunch of them would take
to it. Even have a chase is an improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll get back to talking about the Braves when we come back, plus other division races that are going to come down to the wire. We're halfway through our baseball power hour here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. Stick around.
On the Line with Jacob Goertz on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader.
We're halfway through hour number one here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. Also halfway through our baseball power hour with Lindsey Crosby joining us in the studio. And we continue talking all things baseball, in particular Major League Baseball for now. And we've been kind of diving into a lot of these division races, Lindsey, with the Braves, who are hanging around trying to get things going. But you mentioned at the start of the show, so many of these races are still extremely tight as we're, what, 4 or 5 weeks left in the season, which isn't always the case at this time of the year.
Yeah, usually right now there's one division that's a complete runaway. I mean, there's just one division that
usually
is not
the Astros
even,
or the Dodgers or something like that.
It's usually one of the West divisions, and right now the Astros are half a game up on the Seattle Mariners. That's a two-team race. The Rangers are 8.5 out of it. The Angels aren't going to catch up. They're 11.5. You know, and that's a small lead. Again, the West is 3.5 games. Dodgers, Diamondbacks, Padres. Real quick, just came out. James Paxton has a partially torn right calf. He said that it's very likely that he's out for the remainder of the year, but he is attacking rehab with the hope to make it back before the season ends. As of 10 minutes ago, my buddy Rob Bradford of the WEEI put that out.
Well, that's – I hate that for him. I mean, that's –
I hate that for y'all, too.
I expect nothing less at this point.
It's just, like, teams moving on from productive guys, just to kind of detour for a quick second. Paxton getting DFA'd. He wasn't bad when he left.
No.
Like, when L.A. chose to DFA him. He had a, what is it? He had, like, a 4.43 ERA. The strikeouts weren't necessarily there, but, like, he wasn't allowing a ton of runs. He had a couple early blow-ups, kind of inflated that a little bit. They just DFA'd Amed Rosario when Mookie Betts came back. Amed Rosario is batting over 300 this year, and they DFA'd him.
Was there no way to just move him? just keep him around?
You can't make trades at this point.
Well, I'm just saying, on their own roster.
I don't quite understand. Like, you had options to send guys back to the minors. You could have moved an outfielder for him. Some of your stuff right now, I mean, you've got Nick Ahmed, who you got off of waivers. I think in June, there was places you could have made other moves and kept a dude batting 300, but no, they decided to go ahead and move on from him. Just odd. Sorry. We were talking about the standings, the division standings.
Yeah.
Yeah. The big one that's interesting to me, I don't think we're going to see more than one team out of the AL Central. Okay, we kind of touched on that. Cleveland, Minnesota, Kansas City is that race right now. The Twins and Royals are both wildcard teams. The second and third wildcard teams in the American League. But again, this Kansas City team has been too good this year, surprisingly, but they invested, they went for it. I think a lot of it depends on the health of Bobby Witt Jr. We saw a report, I think it's a hand issue with Bobby Witt. He's in the lineup today. He is supposed to be in there. He's playing against debuting pitcher Zebby Matthews, the Twins, one of the big top risers for prospect pitching in baseball. But I think there's an opportunity here for them to knock them out, which only helps your Red Sox.
Yeah, which is what we're all looking out for.
Exactly. We're all thinking about your Red Sox. I think you could see three playoff teams from the AL East if everything breaks right, and then obviously you're going to have, that's going to leave some people out. But the National League is, Brewers look like they're definitely going to be in, Dodgers, Diamondbacks, Padres. I think your battle here is really who gets that last wild card spot, and I think it's, you have the potential for it to be Atlanta. And I did not think in spring training that we would even be discussing Atlanta possibly not making the postseason. But I think we hit that point in the last week when they went 3-7. They dropped that series in Colorado. The schedule's favorable. Again, you've got 7 against Philly. It's only, I think the 18th strength of schedule. You've got the Marlins for 3. You've got the Angels still. You got 5 against Washington, 3 against Toronto. Like, it's some decent matchups. But it's all going to come down to, can you hold your own for those 7 games against Philly?
I have a question in terms of the Braves' playoff chances. I have not looked at the updated percentage in terms of what, you know, ESPN or anybody else is saying. Right. What's the Lindsey Crosby prediction? If you had to put a percentage on Braves making, missing the playoffs, what today, what would you put it at on August 13th? What would you say?
I'm probably 50-50. And okay. That is not as low as I was this time last week, right? Or at the end of last week. I would say it's probably 50-50. And I think it's because you have so many games left against Philly. The league specifically tried to move the schedule where you had some of these divisional games and these top matchups late in the year.
Yeah, we've talked about that.
You're seeing that here. You've got 4 games against the Dodgers still. You've got the Royals for 3. You've got the Mets for only 3, which feels a little odd. But I think it's probably 50-50, and I think that's the best you're going to get unless you continue to beat Philly. You have won both series against Philadelphia this year.
Yeah, I believe it was 6-2. Is that correct? Or at least, I know it was at least something along those.
I believe it's 6-2. Let me see. Yeah. Atlanta's 4-2 against Philly. They have 42 runs to Philly's 21. So Philadelphia has had,
they've doubled them,
literally one of their greatest regular seasons in modern team history. And they have not beaten the Braves in a series, and they've been doubled up on runs by the Braves. Now, that first series was a big part of that. Atlanta won 12-4 and 9-3. That helped your run stuff there. But by the time you face them, you'll have Michael Harris back. You'll have Ronaldo Lopez back. You won't have, obviously, Ronald Acuna Jr. You won't have Ozzie Albies. But you'll be much better than you've been this summer when you've been playing 500 ball without all these guys all year.
Their first 3 is in Truist Park against the Phillies. The remaining 4 towards the last week, or the second to last week, are in Philadelphia. I like your 50-50 as well going on to it. And it's difficult to say that it's not. As much as it is in the Braves' hands, it's just as difficult from the standpoint that the Mets are only 1 game behind the Braves from that standpoint. And you mentioned the Braves as the 18th hardest remaining schedule. The Mets are the 19th.
Right behind
and
them.
The Mets' schedule gets more difficult as those final weeks progress with the Braves and the Phillies. They have, again, as you mentioned, 3 more with the Braves, 7 more with the Phillies. But the schedule over these next couple weeks, you got some with the White Sox, you got some with the Marlins, some with Washington as well. The Braves really feel like you got to take care of business, especially for these next couple weeks. Or all of a sudden, you're going to find yourself in that third place spot.
The big thing for me when trying to assess the true talent level of a team is I've always thought you have to win your series against the bad teams. You can't, like, you're not guaranteed to, like, sweeping any team is incredibly hard. And I don't think people appreciate how hard it is to beat the same team 3 or 4 games in a row. But you have to win each of those series against some of those bad teams. And ideally, you needed to get a sweep here and there. Like, 3 against the Rockies at home. They're bad outside of Colorado. You need to sweep that series. 3 against the Marlins. 3 against Toronto. These are not good teams, and you really need to win those series and then just hold serve when you play the Dodgers. Don't get swept by the Dodgers. When you play the Royals, when you play the Mets, and then handle your business against Philly.
A conversation that we have, not just in baseball, but really in all of sports, when you start getting down to the postseason conversation, is you want your postseason berth to be in your control, in your hands. The worst spot to be in is your postseason lives depend on what other teams do, right? Yeah. Other teams winning certain games or losing certain games. Like, and you just have to, yes, take care of business on your own end, but you have to go home and watch the late night game and hope that the Rockies beat who. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. That's, you never want to be in that spot. That conversation comes up so much around the NCAA tournament for basketball and even the college football playoff for football. Yeah. But you're talking about it right now in Major League Baseball too, where, yeah, there you can do whatever you want, but it still has so much impact on what everybody else around you does too.
Yeah, like you are in a playoff spot right now. You are in the last of 3 wild card spots, but you are in the playoffs as of today, and so therefore you control your own destiny. But at the same time, you play enough games with the Mets are one game behind you. Every time they beat you, that's two games in the standings.
Two-game jump.
So I would argue to a Mets fan, you also control your own destiny. Because the team that you have to get in front of, you have enough games against them to make up that deficit. If the Mets had one game against Atlanta left, but they were four games back, you officially need help. Because if you beat them, you're still behind them. But both the Mets and the Braves have enough games where they both control their own destiny if they can just handle their business. And that is, you hope Atlanta's getting healthy at the right time. New York has stumbled a little bit recently. They're 4-6 in their last 10, and they've barely scored more runs than they've allowed all year. And I do think run differential is another telling stat that kind of tells you the true talent level of a team. So Atlanta can do it, but we'll see what happens.
You'd love for the Braves to just go ahead and take care of business, especially against their seven against the Phillies. And then while that happens, let the Mets take care of business as well. Let them win the series against their seven games against the Phillies. And then all of a sudden, the Braves are looking at, I mean, that's a really, really big jump. If you go 5-2 against the Phillies and say the Mets do the same, that could be a big-time flip.
If you go 5-2 against the Phillies and nothing else is different, like every other game for every team is a 500 record, you're three games up on Philly. And if Philly has the greatest start in franchise history, if they have the lead in the division for over 100 games in the season, they're 69-49 right now. It's a really nice record. If they drop, if they drop the division and finish in second place, it may legitimately be the greatest collapse in NL East history.
Wow. What a...
But it could happen. It could happen.
It absolutely could, and that would then bring the Braves the seventh straight
division title, yes.
Golly. Well, that leads me into my question that I've been wanting to ask you. As it stands right now, with so many close races in all of these divisions, this could go on for a little bit here.
Right.
It's August 13th. We have, again, however many games and weeks left, 4 or 5 weeks left in the season. I need a prediction by you right now, Lindsay. You know where I'm going with this.
Yep.
Out of the division leaders as it stands today, which one of them or which one, how many of them will not end up winning the division? And I'm going to read them off right now. Got American League East, currently the Baltimore Orioles, the Cleveland Guardians out of the Central, and the Houston Astros out of the West. In the National League, you have the Phillies on the East, Milwaukee in the Central, and the Dodgers in the West. Out of those division leaders, as it stands right now, which one of them will not end up winning the division?
Cleveland.
That's the only one?
I am a believer in Kansas City, but I think the uncertainty behind Jazz makes me worry that the Yankees don't quite have enough to catch Baltimore, assuming Grayson Rodriguez can make it back. Now, in the postseason, I don't think Baltimore's going to go very far. I don't think they have enough pitching. Regular season, they can get there. But the Astros are inevitable. They're going to do it. I don't see Seattle catching them. Seattle strikes out more than anybody in baseball, and they just don't have enough pieces on offense. The Dodgers, I think they're going to hold off the Padres. The Phillies, I think it's going to be a lot closer than Philly fans want it to be. I think that's going to be it's going to be decided in the final week of the season. But I do think that Philly can probably hold off Atlanta to win the division, if I'm betting on it. And I think the Brewers are probably the safest of all of these because I don't think the Cardinals are that good. I don't think the Cubs are that good. I don't think the Reds have enough time to turn it around. I don't believe in the Pirates. I think the Brewers are probably the safest bet of all of these, honestly.
Sure.
But yeah, 5 out of the 6, I think. Now, wild card.
Oh, that's a different story.
That's a different story. I don't think the Twins make it. I think it's probably Yankees, Red Sox, Cleveland. I mean, you look in the National League, I think Arizona's just had too many offensive injuries. They've lost Christian Walker. They've lost Gabriel Moreno. Kettle Marte's having an MRI today. They lost Lourdes Gurriel to a hamstring issue the other day. It's supposed to be minor. We'll see if that's true or not, but that's arguably 4 of their 5 best hitters out. And Jake McCarthy's raking in the outfield right now, but Corbin Carroll's not been healthy all year with that shoulder that he continually has re-injured. I don't think they're going to hold a top spot in the wild card, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the Giants climbed up and took a wild card spot.
I wouldn't just be surprised by that either. I really wouldn't.
They're 6-4 in the last 10. They seem to have some pitching, but behind Snell and Robbie Ray, Kyle Harrison's been good. And then Matt Chapman is finally living up to his reputation, and he is raking right now. He needs to go ahead and sign the extension offer if they put it in front of him, because I don't think he's worth it, but he's raking, and they've talked about it. If they offer you one, dude, go ahead and take it. But yeah, I mean, it's five and six division winners, but I think the wild card chase is going to get shaken up quite a bit in both leagues.
Well, there's no doubt it's going to be drama heavy on the way down, the backstretch of this Major League Baseball season. And when we come back, we'll take our final break here in this first hour. We'll have a little bit of Auburn baseball news, a little update, nothing crazy, but some few updates as we have Lindsay for just a few more minutes as we wrap up hour number one after this.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7, online at ESPNAU.com, or on the ESPN 106.7 app.
Unfortunately, we wrap up our Baseball Power Hour. Just have a few more minutes with Lindsey Crosby in the studio with us. And during season, we always talk a little bit more Auburn baseball, but with it being August, there's not a ton of Auburn baseball news, but you do have a few nuggets that you want to hit on while you're here.
Yeah, so summer ball is kind of wrapping up. A lot of those summer ball leagues are done, and there was some really good news coming out about sophomore Hayden Murphy. I did some work with a prospect website last year, and one of their employees is working in the Cape Cod League this year. So he has access to a lot of the data and stuff, and he sent me some stuff. We were talking the other day. Pitcher Hayden Murphy is ERA under 3 on the Cape this year. He had a 4.32 for Auburn last year, 17 strikeouts and 16 and two-thirds innings. So about one strikeout per nine, you know, per inning there. Over the summer at the Cape, 18 and two-thirds innings, 28 strikeouts, and a 2.89 ERA. And what I really like is getting some of that advanced data. He threw his fastball a ton this summer, like 70% of the time, which is very high usage, but it's also college ball. You need two pitches. And what I like about the fastball, the velocity's 93 to 94, which doesn't impress a lot of people, but he gets really good extension, which means he releases it closer to the plate than the average player, so it feels like it's faster.
Mm-hmm.
And then the amount of induced vertical break, and I'll explain that in a second, is 21 inches, which MLB average for a fastball, MLB average, not college, MLB average is 17 inches. So what induced vertical break is think about how you throw a baseball, it'll drop because of gravity, right? Induced vertical break is the opposite of that. It is the backspin of the ball keeping it from dropping. The more induced vertical break you have, the harder it is for the batter to line up the ball because it doesn't drop as much as they think it's going to. Like, your body naturally is like, you know how a ball flies and you know where to aim. This ball resists gravity. He has 4 inches of induced vertical break over the MLB average. It is absurdly elite. The best pitchers in Major League Baseball are coming 20 to 21 inches. And he's hitting 21 inches this summer of induced vertical break on his fastball.
Yeah, I mean, four inches is a lot. I mean, that's impressive.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's more than the width of the bat. I mean, that's a complete swing and miss. And so, kind of looking at what he's doing, he's got the fastball. He has a kind of a sweepy slider. It's one of those horizontally moving sliders.
Okay.
He reminds me of a guy like Blake Burkhalter. Going into his third season, Berkey was, you know, a fastball changeup guy as a reliever, and he added that cutter in his junior year and then exploded, ended up being one of the best relievers in college baseball, second-round pick by the Braves, and is now working as a starter for them. He reminds me of a guy in that situation where he's got a really good two-pitch mix with one elite pitch. You can give him one more, I think, with where he releases and stuff. Maybe like a vertical breaking curveball would be really good for him. And he could be a dude that could dominate as a closer and be drafted pretty high this upcoming season if the summer data does hold when he gets into SEC play next year.
Well, that's good news. And, I mean, look, there's nothing closer than playing in the pros than playing SEC college baseball. I mean, there's no secret about that, just how good that this conference has become. Other Auburn news quickly. I mean, every time I drive by, which isn't often right now, but every time I drive by or go over to Plainsman Park on that side of town, man, they just continue to make progress on that thing. It's looking really, really good.
Yeah, I am very excited to see these new upgrades and what everything looks like, and then just get into that. It's going to be better for recruiting, it's going to be better for the fan experience, and it's going to be better for the players as well. And so this is one of the rare upgrades that serves everybody. It's not like a new video board in Jordan-Hare, which is really just for the fans. It doesn't do anything for the players or anything like that. This is something for everybody. This makes everything better, and it's just the start of one of many, a long series of upgrades they're doing to make that one of the better ballparks in the SEC.
Yeah, it's part of that three-step process, that three-step plan, if you will. They already did the behind-the-plate stuff. They've got this going on, and then they'll have the seats and the terrace on top of the wall and stuff like that, right?
Above the monster. We call it the monster. I think it's officially called like the War Eagle Wall, right? But we just call it the monster.
The monster's in Boston.
We just call it the monster because that's what it looks like, but it's going
to
be awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be really cool. Well, man, always a pleasure to have you, Lindsay. Plug it all one more time. Tell people where they can find you.
I'm on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. The writing is BravesToday.com, AuburnDaily.com. The podcast is First Pitch, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome, my man. Always appreciate you. It's so much fun talking ball with you each and every week for our Baseball Power Hour. Let's do it again next week, huh?
Thanks for having me.
So much fun. All right, hour number one is in the books. Christian's hanging out with me for the second hour as well. We'll talk some Auburn football, AP Top 25, and whatever else is on your mind. 334-321-1390. Hour number two coming up.
Is an Auburn Network production.
You are on the line. Live on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader. Online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app. To be on the line, call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502. You are on the line with Jacob Goins.
You're on the line here on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika sports leader. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well as we get underway in hour number two here on ESPN 106.7. I'm your man, Jacob Goins. If you missed any of hour number one, it was our Baseball Power Hour. So if baseball is your thing, then you need to go back and listen to what we had to say. And most importantly, what Lindsey Crosby had to say. He had a bunch of information today, and he always does. But, man, just so much happening around Major League Baseball with the Atlanta Braves and division races and injuries. I mean, it was a really, really great hour. So if you missed any of that and you want to go catch up on some baseball talk, you can find that after the show today on our station website at ESPNAU.com under the podcast tab. I will post that for you there right after the show. So be sure you go and check that out. Here in hour number two, you've got me, you got Christian Griffin, and of course, you're with us as well. We appreciate you being here on ESPN 106.7 and on the station website at ESPNAU.com. And phone lines are open, so you can be a part of the show. If you have a comment, question, or a topic you want to hit on today, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. 334-321-1390. That's the phone line. That's how you call in and talk to us on the show, or you can shoot us a text in the on-the-line text box at 334-784-1067. Before we get into content, want to remind you that hour number two, each and every day here during On the Line, is brought to you by the Orthopedic Clinic. The Orthopedic Clinic is East Alabama's go-to center for orthopedic care, with locations in Auburn and Opelika to better serve you. You can find them online at theorthoclinic.com. Christian, yesterday, Uncle T-Bone and I talked about the AP preseason top 25, and while Auburn may not be in it, they're represented because they play five of the top 25 teams this upcoming season in 2024, which doesn't seem to be as much as they usually have to play.
No, it's definitely not, and it's kind of funny because I was talking about it with a couple guys at work the other day and how, ironically, this is Auburn's most favorable schedule in what feels like a decade, if not even more. But nationally, they still host the fifth or sixth most difficult schedule in the country. But just because of it's only five ranked teams right now, only five of the top 20 that we play, it feels like Auburn's getting off the hook a little bit easy. It feels like something weird is going on.
Yeah, and you know, I'm fine with it, right? There's been always this conversation of remember back when, and I think I alluded to this yesterday, when there was conversations of Auburn, back when the West and the East were a thing, and there was conversations of Auburn moving to the SEC East, and there were people like, oh, that breaks tradition, and I don't want to mess with that. We've played Mississippi State forever. The purists said that, right? Who cares? I don't play Mississippi State every year. And Guess what? I'm tired of Auburn playing the most difficult schedule in the country every single season. I'm tired of it. And so while it's still hard this year, outside people still have it ranked in the top five, top 10 hardest schedules in college football. We have consistently said it's not that bad.
It's
manageable.
It is very manageable. And again, it's comical saying that just based off of what the records have been in the past. And now with LSU not on the schedule this year, Ole Miss not on the schedule this year.
What big misses those are.
I was going to say, and you know, those are two teams that you'd like to feel good about winning one of the two if they're both at home. And now with both of them being ranked and both of them having expectations of the SEC championship and the college football playoff, you kind of trade those two for Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Missouri,
and Vanderbilt.
It's not too bad of a bullet to dodge.
Yeah, look at it that way. I mean, we continue to have conversations, and a lot of Auburn fans do too, about, okay, 8 wins should be an expectation. 9 wins is a possibility if everything goes right. I mean, 10 wins could be a miracle season, right? There's no chance in the world we're having that type of confidence and conversation if you have LSU and Ole Miss on this schedule compared to Kentucky and Vanderbilt.
Well, it's one of those things where look at Florida's schedule right now. They play 8 of the top 20 teams in the AP preseason poll. That would be the topic of conversation that we would have right now.
You better believe
and
it.
That all Auburn fans would be having is, hey, not how can we win more than what our over-under is projected at with 6.5. How can we win 7 games? How can we win 8 games? It could be, how do we find a way to make a bowl game? And That's kind of the conversation that Florida's having right now is, I think their over-under was 4.5 that we did on Friday.
Yep.
And it's not because of the lack of talent that's down in Gainesville. I think Lagway is going to be a superstar at the quarterback position, but it's just the fact of who you're playing week in and week out. I don't know who doesn't like Gainesville, whatever they make their season, their schedule is a couple years down the road. But again, I mean, just starting with Miami, you're playing the top two ACC teams, in my opinion, this year with Miami and Florida State bookending the gauntlet of the SEC. And oh, by the way, we're going to throw UCF in there just at a middle of the year in-state rivalry where, although it might not mean much for the SEC or for that much of your total record, you have to win that for recruiting. You have to win that for any sort of competitiveness in the state.
Which gets us to, which impacts the conversation of the future of the head coach at that program. Yeah. I mean, compare, and I know there's a year separation, but compare, I guess, a year difference. Compare the difference in tones and words that people are using for Billy Napier in year 3 at Florida versus year 2 of Hugh Freeze at Auburn. Like, year 3 for Billy Napier at Florida, I don't know. There's not a lot of people giving him a chance to survive. Some people are higher on Florida than others. Some think they're actually going to make it happen and shock some people. But given what the schedule is, and if it plays out like we think it will, he won't be the head coach there next year. Compared to what is happening with Hugh Freeze and Auburn, where it's like, man, they could win 9 games and continue to dominate recruiting, and year 3 could be the year for Auburn. I mean, that's the difference here. And it's literally one or two games difference on the schedule that changes the tone and the verbiage of those two conversations.
It definitely is. And as much as you don't want to talk about last year with the record you finished 6-7, think about two of those games. You just mentioned about a two-win or a two-win difference with the win or loss record. 6-7 versus possibly an 8-5 year in year 1 with Coach Freeze. Imagine the conversations we're having right now with him. Now, all of a sudden, win total is 6.5. If you can get 8 or you can get 9, you feel like everything is trending in the right direction in Gainesville right now with Coach Billy Napier. Again, it's one of those conversations of you feel like you have to overperform And again, it's not because of the talent. It's definitely not because of the lack of recruiting that he's done in Gainesville. It's just because of what the schedule demands week in and week out.
Is it crazy to ask the question, and I'll open this up to our listeners too, 334-321-1390. If Auburn last year, playing our favorite game, playing the what-if game, what if Auburn beats New Mexico State? What if Auburn beats Alabama? And what if Auburn wins their bowl game? It wouldn't have been Maryland. They would have played somebody else in a different bowl. But what if they ended the season 3-0 rather than 0-3? Whereas you said, now they have, you know, you're flirting with 8-9 wins rather than what you had last year. Is it crazy to ask the question that if Auburn had finished better a year ago, and let's say they got 8 wins, that the expectations would be even higher this year in terms of Auburn fans would then be linking legitimately 9 or 10? Like, that's a very high expectation right now.
Yeah.
But if last year had ended better, would the expectations be higher this year? I think they would.
I would 100% agree with you. And it's definitely an Auburn thing as well, but even just a college football thing.
Sure.
That you sit and you expect immediate results, even with the transfer portal now where you can buy your way, you can buy your bandages to patch up your team here and there. You can't do that in the long run. You have to find ways to legitimately rebuild what you're needing to be rebuilt. And I think you saw, Auburn fans, I think we can see what is beginning to happen. Again, the year has been 2025, has been what the coaches are continuing to put their praise and their highest of focuses on, saying we're going for the number one class that year. So by no means whatsoever does Coach Freeze look at last year and go, okay, well, you saw what we have, now let's slowly start to build. Because yeah, if all of a sudden Auburn goes 7-5 or 8-5 last year, and then all of a sudden you go 7-5 this year, or you go 8-4 and then lose your bowl game, go 8-5 and finish with that exact same record, there'd be a lot more negativity in the world of Auburn football.
I think so too. And I think, yeah, it boils down to fans want to see, and rightfully so, not just fans, administrations and the athletic department and the athletic director and everything like that. You want to see that progression, right? You want to see, okay, year one, let's put an asterisk by it, see how it goes. All right, year two, you want to see improvement from year one to year two. Then in year three, and again, I disagree with the fact that coaches only get 3 years. I don't disagree with that's what it is. I just disagree with that's how it has become. I think it's sad that that's what it's become. I don't like it is a better way to put that. But everybody wants to see that three-year progression. Have you gotten better every single year? And are you taking the program? I don't care if it's Auburn. I don't care if it is Miami. I don't care if it's Colorado. You want to see the progression to where there's a future and you can see the game plan. And for some of these big programs to be competing for a college football playoff and national championship. If Auburn wins 8 games last year and they were to come in and win 8 games this year, it would be seen as a disappointment by a lot of people. And whether that's the right way to think or the wrong way to think, that's up for everybody's interpretation. But there's no doubt about that's how it would be perceived. And it's crazy to think that as bad as the end of the last year was, is it crazy to ask that maybe that will play in the hands to benefit Hugh Freeze?
I definitely think so. Just because you
saw... How wild is that?
Again, that's why I said by no means does Hugh Freeze... Is he happy with how everything ended? But in reality of everything, you saw, okay, we were in the games that we needed to be in, almost, you know, when we were talking with Lindsay, and good teams. You got to win the games that you need to win, and you got to be competitive in the games that you need to be competitive in. You found yourself on the wrong end of those a couple of times, and I feel like it does. It doesn't lower the stock, but nationally, it puts a little bit less pressure on the eyes of the Auburn program, and especially with Coach Freeze. And what he's expecting in year two. I mean, when we think about it, we say this is year two. It's honestly year one and a half with the recruiting classes.
Yeah.
This is the first recruiting class that he's had come in to this program based off of a full year, a calendar year of recruiting. And so, again, that's another conversation to have right there is, hey, this is technically year one of having the guys that he's wanting and not having to, quote-unquote, have your hands tied behind your back with the roster that you were given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another thing that I feel people are not mentioning enough with the 2025 class is it's not start to finish, because we know how high school recruiting works. You've got to be on these guys 3 and 4 years ago. I mean, what, we're in 2024 now. If you're not calling and talking to 27, 28 guys, you won't be in the door. You won't be on the couch in the living room talking to the parents and have them with a hat on the table on signing day. That will not happen if you don't talk to them right now. So Freeze was not around in the beginning of the 2025 guys, but you said that he has at least had a full year to actually recruit them rather than pick up the phone and, I don't want to say beg, but be like, look, we need you. Yeah, we desperately need you.
I mean, that's how it was when he came mid-November, and all of a sudden early signing day is
a month.
January.
Yeah.
You're sitting there with what, 40 days of, hey, we need you for our program badly. And it worked with some of the guys, and we've seen a couple of the guys last year. We expect some of those guys, Keldrick Fault being one of them, to take that big jump.
There you go.
Making the flip from Florida State. Now, all of a sudden, you get guys in that Hugh Freeze wanted to get in. We've talked about it again and again. The receiver class is obviously the highlight of the recruiting class, and it's a Hugh Freeze receiver core. That is what it is. It is physical guys that can go out and win 50-50 balls. Even the guys that had more question marks on them as we entered fall camp. Again, everybody had the expectations of Cam Coleman, but when you hear about the risers and everything with those groups, it was the three others. It was Perry Thompson, it was Malcolm Simmons, and you're hearing stuff about Bryce Cannon, how his ability and how he is competing for playing time in year one. You give him that first year, that foundation to be built, and all of a sudden you give him next year's recruiting class, and that's why you expect, and that's why the coaches talk about the expectations of that rocket ship going up in a 45-degree angle on a little chart if you're looking at it, just continuing to climb.
Sure, and you know that's what I've continued to allude to with this receiver group is, yes, there's a lot of guys in there. There's a ton of bodies in there, more than you've had in a long time. I want to keep reminding people, as much as we don't want this to happen, it's inevitable for somebody to not work out.
Yeah.
Whether it's one of the newcomers in the high school rankings, whether it's KLS, transfers or guys that have been there. I mean, somebody's going to get lost in this rotation, and somebody's not going to work out. Hopefully nobody gets injured. But something's going to happen, and you just have to be ready for that. But Auburn has put themselves in a position to be okay when that does happen.
They've put them in the position to not have to rely on one guy to be the difference maker, whether that's out wide at the running back position, making it to where if one guy goes down on the offensive or the defensive line, there's a hole now on the line of scrimmage. They're putting themselves and continue to put themselves in position to where you have multiple guys, multiple weapons that can go and beat you in many different ways.
334-321-1390. That's the number to put you through to us. We'd love to hear from you. What's on your mind? What do you want to talk about on this Tuesday afternoon? We got a lot more coming to you here on ESPN at 106.7.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7. Call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502.
We continue on here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. I'm Jacob Goins. He is Christian Griffin. Joins me every Tuesday in the studio. He'll be making guest appearances on Fridays as well, especially on Fridays where you're at home for Lee Scott and I'm on the road for Auburn High. I think it's every week that we have alternating schedules.
Yeah, I think there might be one where we're both at home, but there's not one game where we are both on the road, so it works.
That
nice
works out
for,
well. Yeah.
For us, it works out for everybody at Auburn Network, and it works out for y'all that are fans of On the Line, because a couple of games that he'll be gone, it'll be T-Bone and I. If not, it'll be all three of us raising a little bit of cane, talking some football, making some predictions, and some Auburn football as well.
Yeah, the few games that I can think of on September 13th when I'm at Enterprise, September 26th when I'm at Moody, those are the two long road trips. Thankfully, the Auburn High football schedule is pretty favorable in terms of road trips. Those are the two long ones, and believe me, they're long. We do have to go to Central, unfortunately, which everybody knows the track record of that. And then we do have to go to Carver, which is just down the road in Montgomery. Everything else is at home. Everything else at home. And a reminder, all of that gets started next Friday night. Next Friday. I know, it's crazy. Auburn High opens up against North Miami Beach. That's at home over at the Duck, where you can listen which is the best way to take it in, on Wings 94.3 and WingsFM.com. Auburn opened up with North Miami Beach, Vestavia Hills, and Opelika. Yeah, Opelika on September 6th. So that'll be a lot of fun. And then you, Christian, your first few games for Lee Scott, which will start next Friday as well.
Yeah, we are Excel, Lochapoca, and Childersburg. So a nice little kickoff
already.
To the 3A AIS or 3A AHSAA, moving from the 3A AISA. We won't mess that up at all. I promise on air with everything.
Yeah, but you won't forget to mention
excited
that.
For a lot of history to be rewritten. I've talked to a bunch of the guys there as well, and everybody's super excited again for the new challenge. Again, it was time for Lee Scott to make that jump. Excited to see new faces, new uniforms on the other side of the ball. They're really, really excited.
Yep, so that'll be next Friday. Again, Auburn High on Wings 94.3. Lee Scott is on AU 100. That's 100.3 on your radio dial. Well,
just choking up that we're not going to be together in the same booth anymore. I understand.
Yeah, it is going to be different. I'll admit it is going to be different, but it's still going to be a lot of fun, and you're going to do a fantastic job. Thing that I wanted to hit on today was some of the Auburn University guys on football making preseason watch lists. Now, there are people that don't appreciate it, but maybe don't pay attention to it all that much when guys get named to preseason watch lists. And I understand the reasoning, because there's a lot of guys that get named to these lists. I mean, there are not a ton of awards, but they do name quite a few players to each award. Like, for example, the John Mackey Award, the nation's top tight end. There's a lot of guys on the list, but Auburn's Rivaldo Fairweather is on that list. And I think everybody's done a pretty good job at including him when we talk about the receiver group. He's not a receiver, he's a tight end, but he's going to be a lethal weapon for Auburn this year in certain situations. But since Auburn has all those fancy receivers that they can use in the slot and on the outside, you can now use Rivaldo Fairweather or the other tight ends for what they're built to do. You can use them as a tight end rather than, a lot of times, your go-to receiver on offense. I mean, it's exciting for me, and hopefully for you too, and for Hugh Freeze on offense, to say, okay, Rivaldo, it's 3rd and 3. We're going to you, rather than, oh, it's 2nd and 10. We need to gain some yards, and nobody else is open, so hopefully Rivaldo's open.
Yeah, just one of those, well, it seems like he's over there somewhere. Let's throw it across the field and try and find him.
Red zone, I mean, you're going to be able to use him down there where he's not going to be exhausted or double covered. I mean, he won't be able to be. Yeah.
Which, again, is something that we continue to talk about, of how when you have so many skilled guys like that, it feels like you put yourself in a position to be successful from the standpoint of, you can't have those safeties overhanging every single receiver or the one or two receivers that you need to, because other people are going to make you pay for it. Rivaldo Fairweather definitely deserves to be on that list. Uncle T-Bone and I talked about it a couple weeks ago of how, and you just mentioned it as well, he's not necessarily a receiver. He does play the tight end position, but he's got an asterisk by his name because you can put him anywhere on the field and it feels like there's a mismatch. I think you're going to see a lot of 12 personnel with this Auburn team. It's just one running back, two tight ends, because you could even throw Rivaldo in the slot to where it's a staggered 12 personnel.
If you had to,
He feels like you're going to win the line of scrimmage, because it then puts so much confusion on the defense, because then you have two more big bodies that are there to run block and protect the quarterback on the line of scrimmage. And then, as you mentioned, you have Rivaldo Fairweather, Rico Walker, Micah, to go out and
Choked up over there?
Yeah, just
tight end room, so man. Much. It'll get you.
It really does. It really, really does. But just so many different guys that you can put in so many different spots to make the other teams pay.
I'm with you on that. And so a couple of other guys that have been named in, and these have continued to come out. You know, it's about that time of the year where these all start getting announced. How about this one? How about Connor Liu as a sophomore on the Remington Trophy watch list as the nation's top center? How about that? That's impressive. And look, we've heard nothing but great things about Connor Liu even before he got to Auburn. Like, there were so many people saying that Connor Liu will be playing on Sundays. He's that good. He's going to be dominant. Could end up being one of the best centers that Auburn has ever had in its history of being a football program. And He's off to a pretty good start.
Yeah, I would say so.
He was the on the all-freshman team a year ago, and was the, and I didn't know this, was the youngest SEC center on the list as a second-year player. So that's pretty impressive.
And what a way to respond by Coach Freeze of the offensive line being a struggle, being a question mark for this offensive team for, it feels like, years now, whether or not they're going to be solid. And then you look towards the next year, it's okay, well, after they get another year under their belt together, things are going to become more fluid. They're going to be that brick wall that you want. Well, when you have a guy leading the charge like that as a sophomore, I think it means you're going in the right direction.
Got to see Oscar Chapman on Saturday in action punting the football. He's as great as always. I mean, what a resource that he is, and he's been named to the Ray Guy Award watch list, which of course is the best punter, nation's best punter in America. He's just such a weapon. And what's intriguing here, maybe not in such a good way, is Freeze talked about how special teams were a little shaky to get things started in fall practice. Didn't really go into detail about whether that was punting, kicking, or receiving and returning, but I mean, my guess is it's on the receiving returning side of things, because Oscar Chapman is, as reliable as they come, and whether it is McPherson or Towns McGoo, a.k.a. Towns McBoom, you're going to be fine either way in the kicking game.
Yeah, I feel like, other than those three players, we feel like, especially on the return side of things, Auburn has struggled pretty vitally in getting really good score, a really good field position off of the other team, kicking the ball off, and especially off of punts. They've been able to win those guys, but especially the kick return, I feel like, has been one of the biggest points of emphasis with this team. And so it's nice to have a coach say that, yeah, we're not meeting that standard right now, but expect that to change.
I'm just tired of dudes fumbling the ball, man. Catch the football. I mean, how many games has Auburn lost? Every now and then.
Okay.
Yeah, just a few times. I'd have to really think about what games it happened in that really affected Auburn negatively. No, just wanted to highlight some of those guys who have been on preseason watch list. Eugene Asante for Nation's top linebacker as well. We've got 30 more minutes here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. Give us a call, 334-321-1390.
On the Line with Jacob Goetz on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader.
We've got 30 more minutes here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. It's the show that tells you like it is and holds nothing back. He is Christian Griffin. I'm Jacob Goetz with you on the Auburn Opelika sports leader. Hit us up 334-321-1390, or you can shoot us a text in the On the Line text box, 334-784-1067. And this may not be the most like upbeat, happy conversation in the world, Christian, but it's extremely serious, and it's something that is happening around the SEC, and I bring it up because Hugh Freeze went out of his way to mention this last week in his weekly presser, talking about major players getting injured. And I believe you and I talked about this a little bit on Friday, but the fact that it is continuing to happen around this league is concerning, I think, because the big one was Texas losing a running back. A&M has now lost a running back, which he wasn't projected to be a starter, but he was projected to be in the rotation. Tennessee's lost a starter on defense. I mean, there's big name players going down in fall camp, and it's not just a couple of weeks. Guys are going out for the year.
And it's whether it's ACLs or it's ankle things. We just had a guy from Kentucky, Chip Trainum, was an Ohio State transfer that broke his hand either yesterday or the day before. And so, I mean, it's just guys you feel like are losing left and right. And it's not, again, it's not names that you feel like are the third string guy that might see the field every now and then in some garbage time. It's guys that you are somewhat relying on to win you a couple games throughout the year. And then you mentioned a couple other guys with Cedric Baxter, Terry Middleton, both at Texas. Christian Clark is now injured. And again, another part of Texas's offense, it feels like you just continue to go down. The more you read, it seems like every team in the SEC is losing two or three guys that you really would like to see healthy. And that's why, as you mentioned, Coach Freeze is putting such an emphasis on the yellow jerseys at practice, the no contact jerseys. And even during that scrimmage this past Saturday, how there was very few contact points, because as much as you want to get guys ready for Saturday, you have to get them to Saturday.
Which is such a, I mean, that's a statement. I mean, which, in it's scary to think about it, because so many of these teams are, you know, preparing for this season, and coaches are trying to save their jobs and protect these kids and get them to the next level too. And it, I don't know, it's a wild concept to think that you have grown men that are relying, their jobs rely on the health and safety of a big time player, but it's where we are in college football. But you can tell that Freeze, even though he may be happy with the current roster, right, he may be pleased with where they are and how much better they are year to year, but there are still big-name players at big-time spots that if somebody goes down, it's going to have an impact. And it's come up on this show last week about, you feel like if somebody goes down, you're probably okay compared to last year and in years past with the linebackers or with the, you know, with DBs or heck, even quarterback. I mean, you go, you lose somebody, which you never want to see, but it was, oh crap, here we go. Linebacker is the one that always sticks out to me.
Yeah.
Auburn linebacker rooms have been, if KJ Britt goes down, we're done. We have nobody there.
Yeah. You are, you feel like you're one and a half deep at every spot. You have your starting three, and then you have the middle linebacker that can also play a little bit of right outside linebacker. You have the left outside linebacker that can play some middle linebacker, but it's that one name, the head honcho, or that the guy you rely on to stay healthy, and all of a sudden he goes down and you feel like everything else is going up in flames.
Want to go back to the preseason top 25 in the AP poll, and it's been thrown around by us as well that Auburn has five games on that on their schedule of opponents that are currently inside the preseason top 25. Georgia, Alabama is on there, Missouri and Oklahoma and Texas A&M. Right, and all of those, you can make a case for how important those games are. And so I'm going to ask you, because I've seen, and I didn't come up with this, I've seen other people talking about it, and I wanted to jump on it too, and opening it up to our listeners, 334-321-1390, or the text box at 334-784-1067. It's a two-part question, which I hate, but okay, I'll do it anyway. What does Auburn need to go in those five games record-wise? And what do you think Auburn will go in those five games? Ooh. For Auburn to have the successful season that you believe in your mind, which everybody can have a little bit of a difference of opinion on what a successful season is. We've had that conversation before. But for that to happen, whatever that successful season is in your mind right now, what does Auburn's record have to be in those five games for that goal to happen? Against Georgia, Bama, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Texas A&M.
I think both home games are needed. So 2-3 at worst. You beat Oklahoma and you beat Texas A&M before the Iron Bowl. I think if you can go 2-3, it puts you in a spot to make a decent case, because then you win Alabama, you find a way to beat Cal, which I thought was going to be your question, which is the most important game on Auburn's football schedule. We can ask that one here in a minute as well, because that my answer is the Cal Bears for that one. Sure. But New Mexico, you start 3-0. If you beat Arkansas, then you beat Oklahoma. That's 5-0. Say you lose to Georgia, say you lose to Missouri, two of the top teams. You're still sitting at 5-2 after your first bye week. Then Kentucky and Vanderbilt, even if you split those, you're 6-3. You beat Louisiana Monroe, 7-3. You beat Texas A&M, 8-3. Alabama, worst case scenario, if you go 2-3 against those ranked teams, you're sitting at 8-4. And I think because of that, and you took the again, you took care of the games that you needed to take care of, and you won the home games that you felt like you have the better chance of winning than necessarily on the road. I think if Auburn were to find a way to go 8-4, I don't think you'd hear too many complaints.
I'm torn on this because I'm in agreement with you that Auburn should win the home games of those five. You should. I expect you to beat Oklahoma and Texas A&M.
I know where you're going with this.
Do you?
I do.
Okay.
Because Auburn is not necessarily historically known for being able to compete outside of Jordan.
That's exactly right. It's historically not Auburn's strong suit to walk into an opposing stadium and win games. Yes, they've done it, I know. And yes, you've had times where they've dominated, but I don't care about Arkansas. I'm talking go and take on a top 15 team.
Go beat Missouri and Columbia.
Yeah, exactly. And look, again, Auburn has done it. I'm not saying they haven't. It just hasn't been their strong suit at times.
Right.
And so while that is extremely true, I'm still torn because for my idea for a successful season and how you get there is to win the games you're supposed to, a.k.a. beat the teams you'll be favored against. Your first four, I don't know if you'll be favored against Kentucky on the road. I would like to think you will be, but I don't know the answer to that. I think it depends on what both teams look like up to that point. Let's say you should beat Kentucky, Vanderbilt, and ULM, and Texas A&M. I think Auburn will be favored in that game at home. You win all of those games, okay? That's step one for a successful season for me. Win the games you're supposed to win. Don't drop stupid games.
As of right now, according to ESPN, Auburn has a 53.8% chance to win in Lexington.
Okay.
So that's just about, I mean, if you followed that with the spread, then Kentucky's a point and a half favorite.
If that. So, but again, I put the Kentucky game as one Auburn should win.
Yeah.
I expect to win that one. So that gives me what? That gives me four. That gives me Kentucky as five. That gives me Vanderbilt as six, ULM seven, and Texas A&M eight. You just beat the teams you're supposed to beat, and Auburn has a successful season, right? Then the next step for me,
throw in one upset.
One upset. One team you're not supposed to beat.
Yeah.
And guess who that could be? Oklahoma at home.
Who is sitting at a 62% chance to win inside Jordan Hare.
Boom.
But again, that's throwing Oklahoma as a 4.5-5 point favorite, which, again, is one of those things in Jordan Hare. I think you would take that.
Yeah, and so I sit with 2 and 3 also. And again, the original question is, of the five games that Auburn has against preseason top 25 teams, what does their record need to be for Auburn to have a successful season in your mind? I'm saying 2 and 3 also. You don't have to have a winning record. It would be nice. If you want to start talking crazy and go playoff implications and things like that, then yeah, you probably need to go 3 and 2 or 4 and 1 or something like that. But for Auburn to do and have a really good year, in my brain, in my formula, Auburn can go 2 and 3 in those five games and still win 9 games.
And think about it too. If Auburn were to go 9 and 3, do what we were talking about, win the games you're supposed to beat, or beat the teams you're supposed to beat, and then be competitive in those road games. Say you lose to Georgia, Missouri, and Alabama. So those would be the three road games that you would lose. But with Georgia being the number one team in the country, Alabama being the number five team in the country, right now Missouri sitting at 11th with hopes of an SEC championship and hopes of a conference playoff championship. What if those are the three teams that are sitting atop the SEC come early December? And all of a sudden you're looking at yourself at 9-3 as well going, okay.
I mean, it's kind of good to me.
It's kind of the scenario with Penn State over the past couple years. It feels like they go 9-3 or 10-2 every year. They lose to Ohio State and they lose to Michigan. Yet that being said, you feel like you put them up against any other team in college football and you feel like you're giving them a chance.
And at that point, you can't have any complaints, I don't think, if you're Auburn or an Auburn fan. I mean, and if you're Hugh Freeze, I don't think you're disappointed in that sort of a result. Yeah, if you're 9-3, you beat all the teams you were supposed to, you got Oklahoma on your home field, and your only three losses are three of the top probably five teams in the SEC, just because Ole Miss will probably be in there. I think LSU is going to be in that spot too. So, I mean, Auburn, at that point, you're sitting at fifth or sixth in the conference, and your only three losses are to three of the top teams. Two of those are going to be playing in Atlanta. Some combination is a pretty good bet.
Yeah.
I mean, between Georgia, Bama, and Missouri. So that's the dream scenario for me, I think. I think that's the dream scenario, but I think it's a real possibility if everything comes together. And I'm not getting into the technical side of the players and the positions and things like that. I'm simply talking games on the schedule and wins and losses. You beat the teams you're supposed to. That gives you 8 wins in my book. Just off the rip.
Yeah.
Do what you're supposed to do. And you get 8 wins, which is already a good season. And then remember earlier how we were talking about from year 1 to year 2 to take the next step and to prove that you're going in the right direction? Getting an upset win does that for me. I think that is what completes that second step. Yes, getting a couple of more wins is nice. But as we mentioned earlier, you should have had 8 wins a year ago.
Right.
I mean, Freeze talked about on a different show how he should have had 2 more wins over Saban. You should have had 2 more wins last year. And so 8 wins this year, while it's good, I want that upset win to go along with it.
And as much as an upset would be nice, whether that's at home or on the road, even if it means you win the 2 games at home, you lose the 3 on the road, being competitive in those 3 games would do as much, if not more, than one fluke upset against a team. Say Missouri doesn't pan out like everybody thinks, and Missouri finishes 7-5, but halfway through the season, it looks like a good win.
That's a good point.
I feel
like,
you want it to be, if you're not going to get that upset on the road, keep Georgia at their own place by a touchdown.
Yeah.
Or keep Alabama halfway through the fourth quarter at their place. Make it to where it's not a fourth quarter and none of their starters are on the field.
I like that. That's a really good point and a good way to get to break. I know you got to run, so I appreciate you being with me on this Tuesday, as you always do. Go and try to make a few dollars tonight and get back here on Friday.
We're going to try to, yeah. I will see you. I'll see you before Friday,
yeah.
But everybody else will hear me on Friday.
There you go.
There we go. It works for me.
Cool. All right, we'll take our final break, come back, and wrap it all up here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7, online at ESPNAU.com, or on the ESPN 106.7 app.
Winding down here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. We've had a great show today, man. It's been a lot of fun on this Tuesday afternoon. We started everything off with our baseball power hour. Lindsey Crosby was with us in the first hour. He is with Braves Today. He's with Auburn Daily. He does so much different baseball coverage and baseball podcast. And so you can find him on X at Crosby Baseball. You'll be able to find everything that he's got for you on there. We had a lot of really good conversation. He was on it today. Had all sorts of information around Major League Baseball with all the different division races that are going on right now. Some of the closest races we've seen ever across the board in Major League Baseball. I mean, there's nobody that has a double-digit division lead in August, halfway through August, which if you're a baseball fan, you just know how insane that truly is and how many divisions are within just a handful of games. And so we broke a lot of that down in the first hour. Also had good Braves insight. Lindsey said last night's Braves game was the best game he has seen all year long at any level in baseball. He said it was the best game he's seen all year long. And you can go and find out why he believes that in the podcast later on today. You'll find it on our station website at ESPNAU.com. Had a few Auburn baseball notes in there too, so be sure you go and check that out. And then here in hour number 2, Christian Griffin was just with me, voice of Lee Scott. He had to run, get to work, but he joins me on Tuesdays. We've had all sorts of different conversations, talking AP Top 25 for the preseason, with Auburn having 5 of their opponents from that preseason Top 25. And I think it ended up, I mean, it could be more, right? If Kentucky ends up being halfway decent, they could be ranked by the time Auburn takes that trip or you know, any others. And the thing that, again, that I get to is the fact that LSU and Ole Miss are not on the schedule. It's those two, man. Those are the two games that are the difference in Auburn having the hardest schedule in the country like they always do, or like it is this year where it's still difficult to those outside, but we continue to look at it and say, not that bad. Manageable, right? Just replace Kentucky and Vanderbilt with LSU and Ole Miss. And there you go. You'd have the most difficult schedule in college football. So I had that sort of conversation today. Also, with the 5 that are on the schedule, we just wrapped up conversation about what does Auburn's record need to be in those 5 games against Oklahoma, Georgia, Missouri, Texas A&M, and Alabama. What does their record need to be in those five games for Auburn to have a successful season in your mind? So that was a lot of the conversation today as well. Also, showed some love to Auburn players that made preseason watch lists. Eugene Asante, Oscar Chapman, Connor Liu, national watch lists on their position. So all of that can be found in the podcast version of the show today at ESPNAU.com. Want to remind you that Hour 2 each and every day is brought to you by the Orthopedic Clinic. The Orthopedic Clinic is East Alabama's go-to center for orthopedic care with locations in Auburn and Opelika to better serve you. You can find them online at theorthoclinic.com. So we appreciate them bringing you the second hour each and every day during On the Line here on ESPN. Coming up tomorrow on Wednesday, we'll have Jordan Hill of Dogs 247 get some updates from Athens in terms of fall practice, fall camp, any injury updates, maybe some position battles starting to get worked out a little bit, and get some updates from Athens from Jordan Hill from Dogs 247, the 24/7 sports site for Georgia. And Double Deep, Daryl Dapperts will be with us tomorrow afternoon in Hour 2, so you definitely don't want to miss that. We'll get his thoughts on the practice and scrimmage from Saturday, probably hit on some basketball things as well with Daryl, and get his all breakdown of positions and little recruiting. I'm sure we'll have that in there too with Daryl, as he's a part of so many things now. Locked on Auburn, Auburn Daily. They just started a new message board over there. I mean, they got a lot going on. So he'll be with us tomorrow. Thursday will be Chris Gordy, host of Locked On SEC. We'll have Brad Law. Still planning on this year, and I know I think I've mentioned this once, but just to get it out there on the airwaves again, Auburn High's head football coach Keith Etheridge will be with us this season. That's right. He will be joining us each and every week here on ESPN, so really looking forward to that. Of course, they get going next Friday with us over on Wings 94.3 against North Miami Beach. So he won't be with us this Thursday, hoping to get that picked up next week, and then free for all Friday. That's it. I mean, the week is going to fly by. Ladies and gentlemen, as football is here, baseball continues on. I mean, there's a lot going on, and we're covering it all right here on ESPN. I will be back tomorrow, all right? But stay tuned. Bill and Dan taking over for the drive, and then you'll have Doug tomorrow, and then me tomorrow, 2 to 4, right here on ESPN 106.7. Until then, I'm Jacob Goins. Stay safe. I'll talk to you later.